Greetings from the Southern Cohort of the 2019 UC Coro System-Wide Leadership Collaborative. Our cohort project is entitled Best Practices for Leading Campus System-Wide Change Projects, and our deliverables include the production of podcast interviews with influential people in the area of change management, theory, and application. My name is Daniel Jeske, a professor of statistics and the vice provost of administrative resolution at the University of California at Riverside. I'm joined in this interview by my cohort colleague, Laura Baker, the assistant dean for career development in the School of Law at the University of California, Irvine. Our guest in this podcast is Lisa Terry, the director of the University of California System-Wide Leadership and Organization Development. Lisa, maybe you'd like to start by telling us a little bit about your background and experience with change management.
Absolutely. I began working as an unofficial change manager when I worked for the Vice Chancellor of Administration at UC Davis many years ago. And I was in charge of implementing his strategic initiatives and had to strategize around how to get buy-in from the organization. It was a really great petri dish, for lack of a better word, of what would become more formal roles as a change manager. The opportunity to lead multiple change efforts for him created a great foundation for the study of change management as a particular discipline. It was certainly a part of my master's work in organization development. I've worked extensively with Cotter's model, Anderson's model, Bridges, and ProSci as far as methodologies. And I'm a certified trainer in Bridges and ProSci, and then a certified change manager and advanced instructor in the ProSci methodology.
Our first question for Lisa was to define and elaborate on what it means to talk about the people side of change management.
You know, I think as an organization, we tend to focus on the technical side of change initiatives. And, you know, that's about the ways that we're going to actually deliver something different, some kind of solution, new technology, some reorganization, virtually just a new way of doing our work or doing business. And we spend a lot of time on that, you know, the project plan, the project scope, the budget, the timelines, those deliverables. And what we tend to emphasize less are the ways in which we need people to change in order to make those new solutions successful. So how are we going to get the people to ultimately embrace, to adopt, and to become adept at working in new ways or in new environments? And I find that the people side of change in many cases is where our initiatives get stuck or they don't work as well as we had hoped.
On a few occasions, Lisa mentioned the role of curiosity in managing successful change.
I really do believe that change management is so much about being curious around what's going on in the organization. By asking those questions, by understanding where resistance might lie, where there might be barriers that we're not aware of, by asking those questions, I think we can help our solutions or our initiatives be more successful.
We asked Lisa what the important skills are for senior leaders who are leading change initiatives.
When you're leading a change, I think one of the things that there needs to be is a sense of self-awareness and understanding that you have been, as a leader, strategizing the way to move forward and that particular solution for quite some time. And it's really easy to forget that the people in the organization are not that far along in the process as you are. They also need time to process, to better understand, especially that why behind the change that I think as a leader is so concrete and known. And I think secondly, understanding how critical your role is as a leader in change success. Research from a number of sources has shown that effective sponsorship can be one of the greatest gauges for change success. And it's not a role that can be delegated to those who are implementing the change. It has to be embraced by the leader. And I would tell leaders that they need to be active. They need to be visible throughout the lifetime of a change initiative, with support of others, of course. Really know the organization well enough to build coalitions around the change, especially leadership coalitions to help move things forward. And another skill is that communication skill, to regularly communicate, especially the why and the vision for the future, so that those who are impacted by the change have a direction to go, know where the organization is headed. And that regular communication, I think, is going to be really critical.
Lisa, what do you see as the difference between change in higher education versus change in kind of corporate settings?
There are a couple of things, I think, that differentiate higher ed. And the first is shared governance. The idea that all constituents have a voice in determining changes or ways to move forward has implications for the way that we move through change. And I think that for those changes that really impact people, that are significant, that are of significant impact, it will likely take longer, require more sponsorship and leadership, and more support for those communication strategies and feedback, especially when we talk about the communication and support for managers and supervisors who play such an important role in higher education as that middle space between frontline and leadership. And so support for them, I think, is incredibly important and probably more so than corporate. The other thing is we have some really specific subcultures that exist in higher ed. And, you know, from a very macro perspective, we've got administration and academics. And I think that they just approach changes from very different perspectives and have perhaps even a different value system on which they base their decision making. And then you throw in, you know, some campuses have that patient care and health culture, which is yet another very different type of environment. And then if you think about our labs and A&R, all of those subcultures really need to be considered when you're planning for change. And so while I think corporate can sometimes use more top-down, sort of one-size-fits-all approach, that won't work in higher ed. And I think each unique subculture needs or may need some different kind of change management support. And I also think that in higher education, change management probably isn't as broadly accepted as in the private sector. Private sector, the whole idea around change management has been around for quite some time. And I think it's relatively new in higher education. And I think with the whole idea of academics, there comes a sense of healthy skepticism about what might be perceived as something that is corporate. So there's a healthy skepticism that I think we sometimes have to get past.
Lisa, do you think the shared governance structure in UC, which is especially strong, mm-hmm. makes UC a little bit different from some of the other higher eds?
You know, as I've talked with my other higher education colleagues, that sense of really shared decision making is pretty universal in higher education. Yes, it is very strong at UC, but there is a sense that consensus needs to be reached before any kind of change moves forward. And that's just a feature or a part of higher education.
Laura turned the conversation towards discussing the origins of change.
How do you recognize when you need to engage in or ask for a change?
The most compelling reason that I can think of to introduce a change is that there's some kind of risk to the organization if it doesn't. To understand that, to really get your arms around that, it requires a significant level of critical thinking, strategic thinking, and a real future forward perspective. What's the risk to our organization if we don't do something different? And that's really the most compelling reason for introducing a change.
I can think of a number of examples where it feels like sometimes a leader may be pushing a change because they have a different vision. Do you think that
right.
that could be a good enough justification, enough of a reason?
You know, we talked about this a little bit interestingly, in the Northern cohort this week, when we talked about leaders coming in, you know, with a new vision and kind of shaking things up before they get to know the organization. And from my perspective, before one can truly have a vision for an organization, one needs to understand the landscape and understand what the current state is, where we are. Now, sometimes those visions are created by those above us. And so there isn't as much choice in the matter or in the timeline. That said, I truly think that understanding the organization as it currently exists and the people in the organization is very important before creating a new quote-unquote vision.
I asked Lisa to talk about the difficulties change leaders would have if they decided to reverse course.
One of the most impactful and powerful demonstrations of leadership is when we can say whatever we've been working on as a change is not achieving the outcomes that we had expected, that we hoped for, and we need to take time for a reset. When leaders are willing to do that, not just push through to force success, and I put success in quotes there because we're not really achieving that success, right? Forcing an issue can, I think, do more harm to the organization than good, because the people in the organization know when something isn't working, when it's not achieving the results, the impact, the return on investment that we had hoped for. And I do find that those leaders that I have seen or have witnessed being willing to say, it didn't work the way that we were hoping. So we're going to take a look at it again and see the direction, the best direction to move forward. But I think it's so powerful when leaders are willing to do that.
What is the best strategy for recognizing and dealing with resistance?
The first thing I think that we need to do is just expect it. Because it's going to happen. And if we come toward a change knowing that we will experience resistance, I think that we can more proactively mitigate what we know will be those sources. My guess is that if you ask questions of any manager or supervisor, they could probably give you a pretty decent idea of where those pockets of this resistance are going to be and what are some of the reasons behind them. So again, if we're curious, if we ask those questions up front, we're going to be doing ourselves a huge favor. And I think the next one is really providing that feedback loop, the opportunities for feedback. And I think I mentioned this before when I talked with you all about change, that I had to kind of reframe my paradigm around resistance in looking at it as a form of feedback, as opposed to just digging heels in. And we need to pay attention to that feedback. Many times we assume that we know the root causes of resistance, and we may not. And so again, there's the curiosity that comes in. Finding out what's really underneath the resistance may bring about some surprises that will change our approaches.
In today's environment, what do you think is the most effective way that you could get feedback on how change is going?
There are situations in which I am going to need more face-to-face interaction to get feedback than others. There are going to be groups of people and types of changes where I can have an email address for feedback, and it's going to be very, very effective. There are some changes perhaps that I need to go out and actually do focus groups or town halls. And I think that again, it truly depends on the type of change that you're introducing into the organization, how much impact it has directly on the people, and what that culture of the organization is with regard to providing feedback.
It seems like a good source of resistance is just not understanding the why part of change that you mentioned earlier.
If leadership is diligent about communicating the why and doing it on a regular basis, because people need to be reminded, especially as they're going through something difficult, you know, a transition that's difficult, they need to be reminded what it is they're after, what it is we're trying to achieve.
I liked what Brent Rubin said about that aspect of communication. He said, you haven't really explained the why enough until you find yourself just sick of explaining the why to people.
Yes, it's so true.
Frequently unexpected circumstances will arise during a change process. What have you found to be some, you know, reliable mechanisms for handling or managing that?
If we are not really looking at the change as it's in progress, you know, related to timelines, impacted groups, sources of resistance, if we are not really curious about how those things are going, I don't think that we can be agile enough to switch gears and approach things differently if they're not working the way that we had hoped.
What are some methods for tracking, you know, the number of changes that you're engaged in and where they are?
One of the things that I would love to see higher education do more of is approach change from a portfolio perspective. So really looking across the enterprise at the major change initiatives that we are introducing and looking at them as a collective, as opposed to individual changes. Looking at those projects and tracking not only who we're impacting through those particular change initiatives, but the resources that we're assigning to those projects. Through that portfolio management, executives can then, you know, talk about what's happening in the organization on a regular basis and make more informed choices about perhaps what we do now versus what we do later, how we could perhaps stagger implementations so that it doesn't have so much negative effect. If we would look at it from a portfolio perspective, it also provides sort of a central repository for sharing and reporting on all of these major change initiatives.
What do you think the role of consultants is in planning and leading change through an organization?
I think that consultants need to be used very strategically. And part of perhaps those RFPs need, you know, there need to be questions about describing and understanding higher education culture and what kind of barriers that they think that they may experience through that kind of culture and how they've responded. I think one of the things that you have to do if you're a consultant is do away with the consultancy speak. If I am an external consultant, I need to learn to speak the language of the organization in which I'm working. And there's nothing I think that turns the higher education community off more than a consultant that comes in and uses a lot of quote unquote consultant speak. And people stop listening when the consultants do not speak their language.
Yeah, that vocabulary that is used even within one organization, you might have to change it up depending on which meeting you're in.
Yeah, absolutely. Think about a meeting that's focused on your faculty or your academic senate as opposed to your administrative leaders. It's going to be different. And that's where you need to understand those differentiating value systems. You know, what's important to the audience you're speaking to? If you can get to that, you know, get to speaking the why or the ways in which you're implementing in the way that they speak, the way that they talk, and you speak to what's important to them, it makes a huge difference.
What are the advantages or disadvantages to having some kind of these, you know, internal consultants through centralized change management offices?
I honestly don't see a disadvantage for having a central office that's expert in that particular discipline. And I'm not saying that maybe all they do is change management. Perhaps they're working, you know, doing other organization development kinds of things or whatever, because it really, that becomes about the people, right? And especially when we're planning for and implementing enterprise-wide changes, I think having an internal central office that gets the culture, that gets the subcultures, that gets the specific people in the organization can make a very positive difference. But I think that those change management experts need to be given a seat at the planning table. They are the ones that likely understand that people's side.
People that think of it as a dichotomous choice would say that the downside with centralized offices is they might not have the subject matter expertise, being a little detached from where the change is happening. But I think I hear you talking about it more as a partnership.
Right. And the people that are a part of the organization that the central office, you know, this central change management expert is working with, help them understand those particular aspects or attributes of the organization that we might need to be working through and working with. And then that change management expertise can then help that organization address those particular issues that exist. But it absolutely is a partnership, Dan. I couldn't say it better.
What is the best way to convince senior leaders to be aware of thinking about all the dimensions we've discussed here today about managing change? How do we get through to them with all of the important points that we've talked about here today?
When you talk about return on investment, you speak about it in that way. When you talk about affected timelines, when you talk about the effect that the risk to budget, people, retention, some of those things that really are nagging at executive leaders right now. And if we can speak to the way that change management actually will help move the needle towards achieving our goals more quickly and or help us alleviate some of the ways in which we run into resistance, then perhaps we can get to that sweet spot that really speaks to them.
making an impact on senior leaders with respect to change initiatives and making them more successful is our goal as the UC Coro projects. And one way that we thought we could address that situation is by having senior leaders talk to senior leaders through these podcasts. And we certainly appreciate your contribution to that part of our projects. It's been great to hear your thoughts on this today. And we thank you.
Thank you very much for actually including sort of that practitioner side within your areas of learning and discovery. I'm very appreciative of that.
Thanks so much. Nice talking to you.
Okay, absolutely.
The music in this podcast is entitled The Fifth Life by Circus Marcus.